Welcome to Textual Relations, a podcast about love and adaptation. We're your hosts, Courtney and Christian Bates Hardy.
And on this episode, we're covering Howl's Moving Castle. And this is the first episode of our new podcast, so thank you for listening. If you're listening to this just fresh off of the RSS feed or iTunes or however you're getting it, if you're getting it from our podcast webpage, thank you very much for tuning in. I'm one of your hosts, Christian Bates Hardy.
And I'm Courtney Bates Hardy, and obviously, if you didn't catch it from the last names, we're married.
Yes. And we decided to create a podcast about adaptations and not just strictly literary adaptations, right?
Yeah, we're hoping to cover a whole bunch of other adaptations as well, and everything from TV series to maybe a video game.
Video games.
We'll just see how it goes with a couple of short books at first, as Christian gets warmed up on the reading front again.
Yeah, part of the reason why we created this podcast, to pull the curtain back a little bit, was to get me reading again. And also because adaptation as a field of study kind of goes back to the very beginnings of our relationship. Did we take adaptation studies when we were engaged, or were we just dating at the time?
I don't actually remember. I know that we wrote notes in our notes during that class, but none of them were like specifically, you know, detailing what stage our relationship was at.
Yeah, I can't remember. Like, I can't recall if we were just in honors grad courses or if we were in grad studies at the time. But we took a class on adaptation studies with Professor Susan Johnston, who's a professor of English at the University of Regina. And she is interested in adaptation studies, and she's a Victorianist, a Harry Potter scholar, as well as a Game of Thrones scholar. She wrote a book a couple of years ago with another friend of ours, Dr. Jess Battis, who is also moonlights as a young adult novelist under a different name.
And just fantasy novelist.
Just fantasy
in general.
Novelist, yeah. The two of them edited a book of criticism about Game of Thrones, but that's sort of besides the point. My point was that we were in the beginning stages of our relationship. I keep saying that, but I don't, again, who knows? But we were together in this course on adaptation, and we both really liked it. We both, I think, were exposed to a lot of criticism about adaptation that helped solidify our own ideas about high culture and pop art, and sort of came to realize that a lot of the art and film that we enjoy are, in fact, adaptations.
An adaptation theory was something that came into my master's thesis as well, which I wrote on fairy tales, and actually wrote fairy tale poems as well. So adaptation is obviously something that's very important to me.
Yeah, and I'm just ending my previous podcast, which some of you might have heard, which is called Good Movies for Bad People, which is a podcast about exploitation and horror films. And when I was sort of pitching new ideas to the Facebook group for that show, a couple of listeners suggested, actually specifically Scott Clickers of the Married with Clickers podcast, said, hey, wouldn't it be cool if you guys, you know, talked about maybe doing a podcast about movie or literary adaptations, books to film, that sort of thing. And almost immediately, we just started coming up with ideas for things that we wanted to cover and things that we wanted to talk about in the form of a podcast.
And there's so many adaptations around. It was really difficult to narrow things down enough that we could even make a decision about which ones we wanted for our sort of top 10 or a first season, maybe. And I'm sure that list is going to fluctuate as we adjust to what we're doing and how we're doing it, but it's definitely going to be influenced by our personal preferences initially.
Yeah. And I think we're going to both strive to try new things and different things, and also try to bring other forms of adaptation into the discussion here. So again, things aren't strictly going to be based on books necessarily. They might be based on short stories or based on plays. We might be looking at adaptations not just into film, but television, as well as drama, like stage plays, and possibly even, like Courtney said before, video games, maybe even ballet. You know, there's a lot of different things that we have to talk about. So the basic format of the show is it's going to be a monthly show. Each episode, probably we're thinking, well, I guess we'll see how long we talk for today, but I think we want to keep it probably around to 90 minutes to 2 hours per episode. And then we're going to do a little appendix episode a few weeks after the episode is released, where we read your feedback, what you thought about the films, what you thought about the books, you know, what you thought about the episodes, and sort of addressing that and maybe talking a little bit about some of the extra source text that we were reading or secondary resources that we didn't necessarily get a chance to talk about. Courtney, we kind of have a certain theoretical perspective when it comes to adaptations, would you say?
Well, I think the way that we have been approaching it is through a book called A Theory of Adaptation by Linda Hutchin. And it's something that we talked about a bit in the class that we took on adaptation, but it was something that I read more in depth once I was writing my thesis. And I think what I like about it is that it's very straightforward. It's not overly scholarly, I guess. It's pretty matter of fact. Like it's a good tool set, I guess.
Yeah. So Linda Hutchin is a professor of English at the University of Toronto, and this book, as you said, was this assigned to us? Because I don't actually remember reading this.
I think we only read the introduction or the first chapter, but that was what set me off on the path during my thesis.
Right. So I've since read the book in preparation for doing the show. And you're right. It's not extremely theoretical. In fact, like what she kind of does, I think, is provides a means of examining adaptations as adaptations. That's sort of the crux of her perspective, is that we should be viewing adaptations not as
on their own terms.
Yeah, on their own terms, not as secondary or derivative works, but looking at sort of why a thing was adapted, how it was done, you know, for what reasons, into what mediums, and really kind of like examining them from all sides to get an idea of the adaptation's own identity outside of its connection to a source text, if you will. So yeah, that's kind of the perspective I think that we're going to be bringing to our examinations of the adaptations we're going to cover in the show. So if you're interested in that sort of theoretical side, again, like we're not academics, you know, like, I mean, Courtney has a master's degree.
We're ex-academics, maybe.
I'm a grad school dropout.
Pseudo-academics? So, pretend academics?
pretend-ademics. Yes, we're pretenders to the academy, but if you're interested in this theory side of things, then definitely check out Hutchin's book, A Theory of Adaptation. You can get it on Amazon. It's a little pricey. It's like $60, between $45 and $60.
Is it really? I don't remember it being that expensive when I got it.
There are two different editions of it, and like I think the edition that we have, which might be the first or second edition, let me see. I can't see it easily, but it was like you could buy it through a marketplace seller and it was like $45, but the newly revised edition is like $60. But that's still not even as expensive as most academic texts.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a small soft cover book, so it's not a huge tome or anything. It's not going to work as a doorstopper.
No, it's only like 178 pages or something. And
yeah, it's really easy to read in like one sitting.
Yeah. But I think, and again, we're not going to necessarily like refer directly to it a lot, but if you are interested in sort of the theory underlying a lot of kind of our assumptions or our approach, then definitely check out that book. And I think it'll at least like open your mind a little bit, especially if you've never even really thought that much about the process of adaptation and, you know, what goes into making one or why do it in the first place, or sort of how adaptations function as objects of art. But anyways, we're sailing way out into the theory waters. So let's bring things back to Howl's Moving Castle. So where do you want to start with Howl's Moving Castle?
Well, we should probably give a plot summary. Although, do we want to talk about how we personally encountered the book and the film first?
Yeah, I think maybe let's talk about sort of our first experiences, our first impressions with Howl's Moving Castle, because those encounters, I think, with this text and with this film will color this discussion. But also, I think, because the differences of the, there are differences within the plot itself, so going down that rabbit hole will sort of start leading us through the kind of fidelity criticism talk. So maybe let's just start with first encounters.
So okay.
What was your first encounter with Howl's Moving Castle?
I came to Howl's Moving Castle fairly late. It was one of the first Miyazaki movies I ever watched. I didn't grow up with them, so I was already dating you by the time we started watching the Miyazaki movies together.
Yeah, so you encountered the film first?
So the film first, and then about a year ago, I read the book for the first time, and in fact, the whole series. So that definitely colors my experience of the film and the books, because I know a lot of people read the books first, often as kids, and so they have a really strong emotional attachment to the books. And I guess we can talk later about how people reacted to the movie.
Yeah. Okay, so when you first saw, like you said, it was one of your first Miyazaki films. I can't remember which ones we watched first together.
I think it was Ponyo and Howl's Moving Castle that we watched first.
Really? Wasn't Mononoke?
I don't know. I mean, the ones that are going to stick out the most to me are the ones that I connected with the most.
Sure, sure.
And I was really keen on Ponyo because at the time I was writing a lot of mermaid poems.
Well, it's also adorable.
It's also super cute.
So what can you recall, like, back a couple years ago, you know, what you first thought when you saw the movie? Like, what about it appealed to you?
Well, I mean, right off the bat, it's very much has a fairy tale form to it. It's sort of Beauty and the Beast story in that Sophie kind of willingly enters into this almost contract with a man she doesn't know much about and who in fact is turning into a beast. That was something that I really enjoyed about the movie.
And you hadn't really experienced or you hadn't been exposed to much anime prior to Miyazaki either, right?
Essentially none.
Right. So was there anything about kind of the animation style that grabbed you as well, or was it more the story and the theme?
Well, obviously the animation is gorgeous.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what Miyazaki is known for.
Mm-hmm. Well, my own first encounters with Howl's Moving Castle were when it was more or less brand new. I first saw the movie not in theaters because it didn't play in Kelowna where I was living at the time. But I did see it pretty much as soon as it hit DVD. So that would have been, around 2004, I would say, or 2005.
I think it came out in 2004.
Yeah, it says here it was released in November of 2004 in Japan. So I'm assuming it probably came out sometime either in like late 2004 or early 2005 in North America.
Yeah, because it's one of his later movies. So by then, it would have been easily accessible in North America.
Yeah, and at the time, it definitely wasn't my first Miyazaki film. My first Miyazaki film was Princess Mononoke, which I saw when it hit DVD in the like late 90s, mid to late 90s. So I'd already been a fan of his for almost 10 years at the time. And had already seen, I'd been going back, because around the time that he made the deal with Walt Disney after Spirited Away came out, they started releasing a bunch of his back catalogs. So stuff like The Cat Returns and Porco Rosso and Lupin the Third, The Castle of Cagliostro, films like that. I don't think I'd seen Castle in the Sky yet, but I'd seen a fair bit of his films. And initially, I was sort of lukewarm about Howl's Moving Castle. I thought that the animation was incredible. Like, I thought the style of the castle itself looked fantastic. but I felt like the plot was somewhat meandering, and I just didn't really connect with it a whole lot. So that was sort of my first impressions of it. And subsequently, you know, I've now watched this movie probably a dozen times, if not more, and I've definitely come around to it quite a bit. Like, I would say that I go back and forth as to where this fits in my own personal Miyazaki sort of top 10. Maybe we can talk about that in the appendix episode next time. But definitely, it's somewhere in the middle for me. And that's kind of, you know, as I've grown with the film, I've looked on it more and more fondly, which obviously led me to wanting to cover it with you on this first episode.
And it meant that you decided to read the book.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, which... I should say, like, you said you hadn't read the book until about a year ago. I didn't even know this was an adaptation until I think you brought it up. Like, you were like, I'm reading this book. And I didn't know. So I wasn't one of those kids that grew up with the books or with Diana Wynne Jones's fiction at all. I'd never heard of her until digging into the history of this movie and its production. And mm-hmm. as you said, reading the three books. There are three in this series, right?
Yeah. And I should mention, I haven't read anything else by Diana Wynne Jones. I really enjoyed the Ingrid series. The second one kind of comes out of nowhere, but I actually reread the third book, House of Many Ways. The second one is Castle in the Air, which is not to be confused with Castle in the Sky.
All right, so maybe let's talk about the plot of the book then. Do you want to give the quick kind of plot summary of the film?
I feel like I'm going to forget too much.
Well, we don't have to go like super in detail, but the basic, I think, plot of the film is that it is about a young woman named Sophie who, is she called Sophie Hatter in the film or is that only in the book?
No, it's in the film and the book because you can see in the film that the hat shop has Hatter on it.
Okay. Or at least,
unless they're, it's just, you know, a Hatter shop.
Okay.
I don't know.
So Sophie is a young woman who works in a hat shop, which is owned by her mother, Honey, and she has a younger sister named Letty who. Does she work in the shop as well in the film, or does she work at the sweet shop?
No, she works at a bakery.
The bakery, that's right, that's right.
She only goes to see her once in the film.
Right. And on her way home one evening, Sophie is approached by what?
Well, she's going to see... It's on her way to go see Letty when she's hit on by two soldiers.
Right.
She gets very freaked out. And Howl sort of swoops in and saves her and then literally sweeps her off her feet and they fly off and he lets her land into Letty's bakery.
Yes, and Howl is a wizard, if we didn't mention that already.
Well, obviously. There's a bit at the beginning of the movie where they kind of, there's, you know, girls talking in the background, watching Howl's Moving Castle go by and they're talking about how wicked... he is because he kidnaps young girls and eats their hearts.
Right. So after Howl sweeps Sophie off her feet and takes her back to the hat shop, she is met one night by a very nasty customer, the Witch of the Waste, who is this very like large, voluptuous figure, this kind of larger-than-life character who kind of reminds me a little bit of the witch in The Little Mermaid a little bit.
Like Ursula?
Ursula, yeah. She kind of has a slight Ursula...
Like a drag queen vibe?
Not a drag queen vibe, but...
She does have a lot of makeup.
There's a very, like, kind of voluptuous sexuality to her, which I think Ursula also has. I was reading in the book, The Art of Howl's Moving Castle, which I have right here. There's a really interesting quote, actually, from one of the supervising animator from Akihiko Yamashita. He says that they began... creating the Witch of the Waste based on some sketches of an old English lady, and it became obvious that she wouldn't be very appealing if she only looked scary. So following Miyazaki's request, I made her look more erotic in her character design by drawing a full-bosomed, voluptuous woman. In his initial sketches, Miyazaki also drew her as plump and voluptuous, and we drew her in the same vein.
Well, and it makes sense, too, when you think about the fact that Howell is supposed to have been in love with her at one point. That yes. She is a sort of corrupt beauty.
Right. So there is an attractive quality to her, even though she is very, like, intimidating and frightening. And the Witch of the Waste comes in and basically curses Sophie because of her encounter with Howell, essentially. And she curses Sophie to look like a 90-year-old woman.
And Sophie obviously freaks out and eventually decides to leave home and kind of try to make her fortune elsewhere.
Right.
And she travels into the wastes. And in the waste, she meets, she helps out Turniped, a scarecrow who is caught in a bunch of bushes. And in an attempt to make him go away, she tells him to go and find a place for her to stay. And he comes back bringing Howl's Moving Castle.
Right. Which is this giant structure, this kind of rumbling, walking, moving castle. If you haven't seen the film, it looks like it's
very steampunk.
Yeah, it's very steampunk. It's got chicken legs, kind of, which makes it look sort of like Baba Yaga's hut.
Yep.
Which was an intentional design choice. It actually was deliberately designed in some ways to resemble, this is something I pulled up in some of my research on this, to match the art of Albert Robida, who was a French illustrator, lithographer, caricaturist.
I'm not even going to try that.
He made lithographs. Anyways, he was an artist in the 1880s. Well, actually, pretty much the mid-18th century all the way to the early 19th century. And if you look at some of his art, there's a he has this one sketch called Maison Tourante Aérienne, or Aerial Rotating House. Sorry for the French listeners out there who are laughing at my terrible French. But basically,
and your wife who's also laughing at you.
But it's like this rotating house on like spindles, and it looks very much like kind of Howl's Moving Castle. Although in Miyazaki's interpretation of the castle, castle is also very natural looking. It actually looks kind of like an animal or like a dog. It's got a huge face.
It has a tongue.
Yeah, and it has a huge tongue. But we're sort of getting away from the plot here. So anyways, Sophie goes into the castle and meets Markle, who is this young little boy who is studying under the wizard Howl as an apprentice. She also meets the fire demon Calcifer, who is keeping the castle alive and moving. And she quickly puts herself to work cleaning up the castle, basically to make herself useful so that Howl won't toss her out when he shows up.
I'm going blank on what happens next.
Okay, well, what happens next sort of is Howl shows up. He's kind of like, all right, wow, it's pretty amazing that you managed to get Calcifer to obey you. And, like, she cooks bacon, right? She's like,
yeah.
Ooh, you've got bacon and eggs.
That food. I don't know what it is about Miyazaki, but he makes animated food look really good.
His bacon looks incredible. Also, every slab of bacon.
Like, all of the Miyazaki food.
Well, anyways, Howl's impressed that Calcifer, that Sophie could get Calcifer working for her. But then also we get the kind of this sense of the larger plot, which is that there is a war going on. And we sort of got a little bit of hints of this earlier in the, Kingsbury? Is that where Sophie's from? I can't recall where she's from exactly.
I think that's what it's called. And there's kind of murmurings that a prince from a neighboring kingdom is missing, and they're going to essentially start a war over it.
Yes. Sorry, Sophie's from Market Chipping. Kingsbury right. is
where the king lives.
Where the king lives. But yes, so there is a war going on right now, and Howl is being conscripted into this army by Madame Suleiman and the king's army, basically, to fight in this sort of aerial warfare, which and then also going on there is we have the Witch of the Waste and Sophie's quest to undo the curse, which a very important point about this curse is that she can't tell anybody that she
about
is
it.
Cursed.
Yeah.
That's right.
But when she first steps into the castle, Calcifer recognizes that she's under a curse and that she can't talk about it. And that's when he tells her that he and Howl are also under a curse. And the sort of conditions of letting her stay, per se, is that she has to figure out a way to break the curse on Howl and Calcifer.
Right. Although that plays like a lot less of a role in Miyazaki's film than in the books. Like, she doesn't, in the book, Calcifer is constantly saying to her, like, are you going to break that curse? Hey, how's that curse coming along?
Also, you just got your hint, like, 2 pages ago. Better flip back and right. check.
Yes.
This is funny. So I read it for the second time just a few weeks ago. And all of those bits about Calcifer going, you just got your hint. I'd flip back and, like, sure enough, there is the mention of a heart or heartlessness somewhere within that chapter.
The other major part of the plot from the film that we should mention is that every time Howl goes into battle, he transforms into like a giant bird. And all of the other wizards that he's fighting in this war have been transformed into sort of these formless, or these like globular
like kind of bombs
bird
too.
Creatures. Yeah, they look sort of like bombs with wings or like really fat doves or something like that, or sparrows. And so Howl is losing his humanity by fighting in this war that he doesn't want to participate in. He's your classic Miyazaki hero who is like against the war and against, he's a pacifist. He just wants to be left alone. And this is something that
he wants to be free.
He wants to be free. Yeah. And this is a point of the plot where the film really diverges from the original novel, which to go to the novel now, the plot of the book really is about Sophie gaining this sort of sense of herself, taking control of her own life, and really kind of finding herself. And
it's kind of a journey of self-discovery, really.
Yes, yeah. Which, whereas the book is more about Sophie becoming devoted to Howl, Sophie learning to live for other people and finding herself through kind of acts of selflessness, and other characters finding themselves through acts of selflessness. This is something that Miyazaki said was a very important theme to him, this idea of what he called devotion or acts of selfless giving. And we see like how other various characters like Calcifer and Howl give something, even the Witch of the Waste, you know, does something for somebody else, and that helps them grow as people, basically. But that's very different than the plot of the book, which really kind of focuses on this connection between Howl and Calcifer and the mystery about that, as well as Sophie trying to get, like, trying to undo her curse, and the Howl's battle with the Witch of the Waste, who is a very different figure, a very different character in the book than she is in the film. So we're already kind of dipping into that sort of differences. How do we want to deal with this? Do we want to talk about, say, maybe the differences in some of the characters, or we'd want to talk about maybe the divergent themes of the two?
We haven't even gotten through the plot yet.
Well, I don't want to go completely all the way to the end with the plot. I mean, I want to sketch out the broad strokes of it without going beat for beat. I mean, is there something about the plot that you wanted to sort of touch on before we leave it?
No, I think we can start talking about the ways that the characters are adapted.
Okay, so yeah, so something I think that we want to definitely. We don't just want to focus necessarily on the differences between these two texts, but we're going to have to in order to sort of investigate maybe why changes were made to these different things.
Well, and part of that has a lot to do with the fact that books and movies have different strengths and weaknesses. What books do really well doesn't necessarily always translate very well to a film.
Sure.
And vice versa.
Okay, well, that's a great point. What do you think that the book does really well? Like, what are some of the real strengths of the book?
Well, I think one of the things I really like about the book is that Sophie is actually a witch in the book, and it's very explicit that she has this power that she is unaware of.
Right.
And is sort of learning to use and exercise. And it's all based in her voice in particular, that she has the ability to speak life into things. And in the sort of, as an example, in the beginning of the book, she is making hats at the hat shop. And because she's so bored, she's talking to these hats and telling them, you know, you're going to catch a man with a lot of money. And sure enough, the person who buys the hat gets married to a man with a lot of money.
Yeah, and she's the eldest of three sisters, which is an important detail because it's sort of introduced very early on in the book that her three sisters are, they're pretty, they get a lot of attention from men. Everything seems to be going well in their lives, and her stepmother puts her in charge, her stepmother Fanny in the book, puts her in charge of the hat shop because she's the responsible one. And also she doesn't mind doing the work and she likes working in the hat shop. And these are all things that Sophie actually doesn't like. She doesn't want to work in the hat shop. She feels like she's being exploited by her stepmother.
And she also feels like it's turning her into an old woman.
Exactly.
Like it's much more explicit in the book. But to sort of bring it back to problems of adaptation is that it would be very difficult to actually show Sophie's power. It would take up a lot more time to actually go through, you know, the making of the hats and her putting spells on them without realizing it, and then seeing it play out as customers buy hats.
Yeah.
It would have taken up way more time than that initial sort of introductory bit in the film as it is now.
I really like the stuff in the hat shop, but you're right. The book spends a couple chapters there before she even gets to the castle.
Yeah.
And
that's one of the biggest problems of adapting books into film is that everything gets compressed.
Sure.
If you're looking at a book, I mean, this one's not very long, but it still covers quite a bit.
Right. Yeah.
And you can't always squeeze that into a movie that's, you know, 90 minutes to 2 hours.
Right. The other, I think, real strength of this book, and it sort of gets to your initial point about you really liking the character of Sophie. And I think this book just has great characters all around. And the one thing that a book can really do that a film can't, or at least films struggle with.
Howl's even worse in the book, though.
Yes, he is.
In my opinion.
They all are. They're more complex individuals. But what I was going to say is that books can really show character interiority. They can really get you like inside a character's headspace. And I think this whole book really is kind of from Sophie's perspective. Even if there is sort of an omniscient narrator, we get a real clear sense of what Sophie's feeling. And we get an understanding of why she does the things she does. Films have a much harder time showing us why characters are, like, what they're thinking necessarily. So I think the reason why...
And then they do goofy things like putting a sort of voiceover for their interior voice, and it just sounds ridiculous.
Well, like you were saying, so Sophie has this magical ability to make things, like, she can imbue things with power by asserting herself vocally. In a film that would come across as really awkwardly because it would just be constant exposition. Like,
yeah, and she does do things like that occasionally in the film, but it's not made explicit.
Right.
But every once in a while, like when she orders the castle, like, are you going to let me in or not? The castle lets her in.
I think the other thing that films often require too is some kind of POV character, somebody that the audience can sort of insert themselves into the narrative with, and those characters tend to be not people without special abilities or powers. And in this case, this is Sophie. She's kind of this ordinary person thrust into this magical world with wizards and witches and, you know, talking fire demons and moving castles. You know, I think she's sort of an audience surrogate in some ways, at least in the context of the film.
Yeah, the book almost takes for granted, like, this is a fairy tale. I think from the first opening lines, even, it's, I'm the eldest of three daughters, and anyone who's ever read a fairy tale knows that's bad.
Right, right.
So it sets it up right away within the book. We're operating in a fantasy setting, and it's much easier for the reader to just sort of dive in.
Which makes the choice to make this as an animated film, I mean, that seems like an obvious thing to say because, well, it's a Miyazaki film. But the choice to make it animated, like anybody could potentially have bought the movie rights to this and to mm-hmm. make it animated. And
although
bring it-
I think Miyazaki in particular is an interesting case as far as, you know, choosing to animate, because he doesn't really see a difference between animated movies and real life movies, whatever you want to call them. Like, he very much believes that you should be able to portray whatever you want,
right,
including real life,
yeah,
in animated movies.
He doesn't shy away from subject matters necessarily.
I think he probably also subscribes to more of the idea of, you know, these tales are for everyone, not just children. He's not making animated films to appeal to only an audience of children.
Right. He's trying to appeal to all age groups.
Yeah.
Okay. But what I was trying to say was just that when you animate something, like, you bring it to life, you give it some kind of visual representation, which when it came from a book, it only existed in your imagination. Mm-hmm. And animation just necessarily is more fluid than mm-hmm. something that is live action, where, like, you have the actors and they can only really look one way until you start tinkering with, like, CGI. You know, you could argue that modern day movies are just animated films, but this film has...
Yeah, I mean, Harry Potter really kind of puts a lot of that kind of thinking to rest, as far as, you know, it's really difficult to show dragons, and then Harry Potter comes along and is like, here's a fucking dragon.
Right, here's your fucking dragon. And in case of this movie, one of the things that I think it does that we don't really get in the book is we can see Sophie's curse visually, and it changes. It's very mm-hmm. fluid throughout the film as we see her age kind of fluctuate from the 90-year-old woman to, like, more like a 60-year-old woman, and then to a young woman with gray hair.
And the curse is really attached to her emotions. She tends to revert back to her young self, especially when she's vulnerable. But as soon as she feels like she has to protect herself, that's when she snaps back into the old woman.
Yeah, and we never really get a sense of that in the book. We, as far as we know, she's just looks like a 90-year-old woman right mm-hmm. until the very end, and occasionally gets kind of bursts of youthful energy. But the film really allows us to kind of see how the curse, as you said, is tied to her emotions and to her assertiveness.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I like the most about the film. And kind of full disclosure, as a former shy person, Sophie is my people.
Well, she is one of the better, I think, examples of a sort of, I guess, would you say she's introverted?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah?
I think in the film, she's definitely portrayed that way, that part of her curse and overcoming the curse, it's not just learning to love Howl, but learning to love herself.
She comes across more like that in the book to me than she does in the film. And I was reading a little bit about what Miyazaki wanted to show with Sophie's character in the movie. And one of the things that he said was that, and I'm just paraphrasing here, but he wanted to show that old people were not stereotypical, that, like, you know, that an old person could have this energy, could be sharp-tongued. She could, like, whip people into shape, you know, like, and also... Like,
and have someone fall in love with her.
Exactly. Old people can have desires. They can have wants. They can have dreams. Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think Sophie also finds being old freeing.
Yes. And that was something that he also wanted to show, is that that being old can cause you to have a certain freedom. It can allow you to speak your mind because you, like, nobody cares about you anymore.
Yeah.
You're forgotten about.
And it's funny too. I don't know if he did this on purpose, but I think there's a sort of common phenomenon with teenagers, especially, in that they feel like everyone is looking at them all of the time, and it makes them want to hide. But once you get older, once you lose that self-consciousness, you're often much more yourself, I guess.
Right. And in the book, we know that Sophie is 15 years old, I think, right?
In the book, she's about 15.
Yeah, but we never really get a sense of how old she is in the movie. She's just kind of a young woman.
Yeah, which is probably done on purpose, because when you look back at things like The Little Mermaid, she's supposed to be 16 in that movie, and everyone always looks back on that bit where she's like, I'm 16 years old, Daddy. I love him. And you're like, no.
Well, I think it absolutely was done on purpose as well, because while Miyazaki does make movies for people of all ages, I think he also has a real interest in making movies specifically for women or young girls. You look at like a lot of the films in the Studio Ghibli library, and a lot of them are well known for having strong female protagonists.
And I think that's why Miyazaki is known as a feminist filmmaker. And I would argue that Howl's Moving Castle is also feminist. I said earlier that it was a Beauty and the Beast story, and Beauty and the Beast gets a lot of flack from feminists, as far as Stockholm Syndrome and all of that. But as I sort of mentioned before, I think Sophie's journey in the film also has a lot to do with her finding herself and having confidence in herself. It's part of the curse breaking as well. She's in control of it, and when it's broken at the end, I think it's very telling that when Howl tells her her hair is beautiful, she says, I think so too.
Right. So in terms of adapting Sophie as a character, we already talked about how the film allows us to see the effects of the curse on her. It shows that it's tied to sort of her emotions and her assertiveness. And you talked about the ways in which Sophie is kind of constructed as this sort of feminist heroine throughout the film. Now, in terms of, you know,
She's cunning in the film as well as the book.
Okay, but in terms of the, like, I agree with you, but in terms of the translation between the two texts, do you think that Sophie is essentially the same character, or what are the ways in which you think that she is maybe, like, what changes were made, and how do you feel about them?
That's a loaded question. Sophie's character does change quite a bit from the book to the film, specifically surrounding, you know, what we were talking about with it not being explicit that she is a powerful witch in the film.
The main change that I see personally is just that because we get that amount of interiority into Sophie's personality in the book, I feel like Sophie is a more complex character. She's not strictly kind of an ideal protagonist. We get that she is selfish, she gets jealous, you know, she loses her temper a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, she's kind of, she thinks badly about herself often. She's very like self-defeating. She you know, tells herself that she's a failure constantly, and we never really get that side of her personality. Like, her personality is very streamlined in the film.
Yeah, I guess in the movie, her biggest fault is just that she kind of cries at the drop of a hat.
Right.
But it's funny that you mentioned her specific faults in the book, because I was just reading the interview with Diana Wynne Jones, and she was talking about how she thinks that characters who don't have any faults are boring. And it's definitely something that she did on purpose, that she wanted Sophie to be flawed.
Yeah.
And just to go back to like my argument that the film is also feminist, I think that by choosing to adapt it in such a way that there are three characters in the film who are all women, all powerful. So we've got Sophie, the Witch of the Waste, and then the decision to make Madame Suliman a woman, but in the book it's
the wizard
Suliman.
Yeah.
A dude. And
yeah, I think his name is Ben Sullivan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all of those characters sort of show multiple facets of womanhood. None of them are confined to one little box of being, you know, perfect princess.
That's interesting. And I think you brought up a good point, is that there's also no real villains in this film. Like, nobody is strictly good, nobody is strictly bad, and that was a very deliberate decision. Miyazaki said particularly that he didn't want this... Well, for one thing, he doesn't believe that anybody is sort of irredeemably evil. He believes that, like, good people do bad things all the time.
Yeah, and he actually offers the opportunity for the Witch of the Waste to be redeemed in the end.
Yeah, and that was a very deliberate decision. I have a quote here from one of the supervising animators on the film, Takeshi Inamura. He says, "I worked on portraying the Witch of the Waste as caring, so she wouldn't be seen as a simple evil character. She herself doesn't consider herself evil at all, and in fact, she isn't a bad person." So that's kind of really interesting that right from the get-go, like, they were kind of deciding, making all these decisions, both in the design of her character, like how she's even represented, like, visually, to show that she's not 100% bad. And I think that's true of Madame Selma.
Which is
as well.
Hilarious because she gets into the castle and she's still like, "No, I really want to eat some young men's hearts." And Sophie's like, "Oh, you're so bad."
But yeah, it's bad in that, like, "Oh, you" sense of it is. And
like, "Oh, you're old and cute."
Well, and even, like, later on in the film, we're sort of going on to the changes now to the Witch of the Waste in the from the book to the film, but even at the end, even after she becomes this much older looking woman and much, like, almost borderline senile, you know, she's still a little bit selfish and, like, a little bit feisty all the same. Like, she's a fully developed character, which is something that I think, you know, I think overall the characters somewhat suffer in the film from being a little bit streamlined from the book, but the Witch of the Waste still remains a compelling three-dimensional character. She's even more three-dimensional, I would say, in the film than she is in the book, where, like,
she was pretty much strictly evil in the
book. Yes, and that is one of the differences, I think, between...
But she's also, I guess, the warning for Howl.
Sure. Like, one of the things that Dinah Wynne Jones is on the record as saying is that she does believe in, like, real evil. That that there is pure good and there is pure evil, and some people are...
Damn, was she evil.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a real difference in between these two stories, for sure.
Like, making the ultimate human out of three different wizards' bodies is super fucked up.
Yeah, that's a major plot point that comes in late in the book and that isn't featured at all here. It's reduced to, in this case, just the prince is been transformed into Turniphead the Scarecrow, whereas in the book, like, the prince and the wizard Sullivan have been, like, switched. Their pieces of their bodies have been removed and swapped around into other characters, which is something that's really messed up.
And wreaks havoc with their memories as well.
Yeah, yeah. So we talked about the Witch of the Waste and changes made to her character, as well as we talked a lot about Sophie. Let's talk about some of the other characters that have been translated from the novel to the film and maybe how they've changed. There's the character of Michael in the book, who is Howl's
who
apprentice.
Who gets renamed to Markle.
Markle, yeah. Or Marukaru, like, or something in
I
Japanese.
I just like saying it.
Markle. Markle is fun to say. And the major change to his character is one of age. In the film, he is like a little boy. And in the book, he's like a 15-year-old. He's basically the same age as Sophie. In fact,
and he's courting her sister in the book.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't really have any issues with this change. In fact, in some ways, like, I kind of like the fact that he's just Howl's little apprentice.
And it puts Sophie in more of a mothering position, I guess.
Right. Although the major difference, I guess, like you were saying, is that because in the book he's a wizard's apprentice, he helps Sophie learn magic. And she sort of...
Like, and realize that she can actually do magic.
Yeah. So without him...
And he's another sort of example of exploitation and work in the book, which is a big theme in the book, I think.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. I don't really want to get too deep into that theme just yet, because I don't want to...
You want to save that for Howl?
I don't want to lead us away from the characters necessarily just quite yet. But yeah, like, so Michael's a big change, but I don't think it's... You know, in some ways, the film, like you said, needs to condense a bunch of things, and it needs to streamline, and having Michael be a major character might just detract too much from the main story that he's telling, which is about, you know, Sophie's journey of self-discovery.
Well, and the danger too, if you have someone who is the same age as Sophie and doesn't have another love interest, then you have a love triangle, and right. nobody wants that.
No. Although it's not there in the book, but I could see how they could easily go down that road.
It would be much easier to see in a movie, though, because you'd be going, well, why doesn't she go for the more practical guy who seems to have his shit together?
The only major, like we mentioned that in the book, the wizard Sullivan, who's actually like just a good character. He's, you know, there's nothing wrong bad about him. He gets changed to, Miss Sullivan
Madam Sullivan.
Or Madam Sullivan, right, in the movie. And she is kind of an antagonist. She's rounding up wizards to fight in this war that Hal doesn't want to participate in.
But at the same time, she also kind of forces the Witch of the Waste and Howl to confront their faults and the paths that they're taking,
right.
which are leading in bad places.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, some changes were made to her character. I don't really have... I mean, she's kind of an amalgamation of Mrs. Pentsemon from the book, as mm-hmm. well as the wizard Sullivan. So I don't really have a problem with this change. I think it's just a matter of, well, we need to condense a bunch of characters into a single character. The only other major...
Which is another thing that happens quite a bit in adaptation.
Yeah.
Because if a character can serve the same function as multiple characters, it makes it much easier for a visual audience to go, oh, that's who that is.
Yeah, and we really didn't need Miss Pentsemon in the film, because I think having Howl be mourning, like being in mourning for several minutes of the film, or like possibly 15 to 20, like we don't really need to see Howl.
Yeah, in the middle of everything else that's going on, it would have taken away from the movement of the plot.
Yeah, yeah. The last character I kind of want to mention briefly before we leave this kind of discussion of these changes is Calcifer, who...
We didn't talk about Howl.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess we didn't. But so
we could talk about Calcifer and Howl.
Okay, all right. So Calcifer is Howl's fire demon, and he was in the plot of both the book and the film. He was a shooting star that Howl caught as a young man, and they made a deal that Howl would get magical powers through Calcifer in exchange for Howl's heart, and to keep Calcifer alive, basically burning. And we learned that Howl has this ability to extract parts of himself, like he can take something out of himself and keep it alive. So that's we learned that more in the book than in the film. But anyways, in the book, Calcifer is kind of a very frightening creature in terms of how he looks. He's got sharp, pointy teeth. He's full of flames. Like, and
he's like black and purple or something.
Well, he's a bunch of different colors, but
yeah, but he's supposed to be much more scary in the book.
Yes. And in the movie,
and then in the film,
he's a cute little Billy Crystal. I'm Calcifer. I'm a little fire demon. I don't really have any problems with how he was changed. I mean, sometimes I wish maybe that they would have gone a different way, but
he does have a couple scary moments in the film when Howl has to move them to the hat shop. Calcifer goes all like huge and freaky, but otherwise, like, he's just, you know, tiny orange flame.
You know what he kind of reminds me of is actually like a little flame version of Ponyo, when Ponyo is just like a little tadpole. In some ways,
and
you can kind of see
tiny
them.
And she gets stuck in the cup.
Yeah, and it looks like they maybe were exploring the same animation techniques, because he's very fluid as well. Like, even though he's fire, he looks almost liquid at some points.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so you want to get to Howl.
Well, he's, you know, the other main character.
He is the titular character. So Howl is very vain, and that's translated, I think, very well from the book to the film.
And that's something that Diana Wynne Jones apparently explicitly asked Miyazaki to do, was to not change Howl's personality in the film. And I think he lived up to that. He definitely still has the vanity.
Yeah.
But I guess the big change is the bird monster.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So, you know, don't fight demons lest you become a demon. Ichi, blah, blah, blah.
Well, but it's also part of Miyazaki's anti-war views. I think what he's trying to say through Howl is that no matter what your personal views, aka wanting to be free and not be a part of this war at all, it still makes everyone who participates in war into a monster.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's an evolution of the same idea that was sort of the foundation for the character Ashitaka in Princess Mononoke, as well as I can't remember her name, but the woman that's like all armor, like she's like a cyborg basically in Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind.
I gotta watch both those movies again.
Well, Howl is different from Ashitaka because Ashitaka is a pacifist, and once he learns that the curse, that the sickness inside of him spreads with every violent act that he commits, he tries to like stop fighting. You know, he doesn't want to fight at all. Howl sort of doesn't.
He leans into it.
Yeah, he resigns himself to his fate in some ways, and that resignation kind of makes him into a nihilist. Like, he doesn't care
anymore.
But
he's also very angry.
Yes.
And I think Miyazaki was also very angry.
Yeah.
At the time, what came out just before or after this movie came out was that Miyazaki didn't actually come to the U.S. to accept his Academy Award Spirited Away.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't admit to it until later, that he didn't come to the Academy Awards specifically because he disagreed with the Iraq War.
Yeah.
And that Howl's Moving Castle was his response to the Iraq War.
Yeah, like I would say a key theme of the film is definitely the experience of life during wartime.
Yeah.
And this movie absolutely has that that feeling of being a commentary on the then ongoing conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is 2004, so the war had already been going on for like 3 years at this point. And definitely you sense a lot of rage at the war. And I think that's where Howl's viewpoint is really coming from. It's this utter disgust at this senseless loss of life. And we hear about
almost a sense of impotence, maybe, that like there's nothing he can do about it.
Right. Yeah, he has to fight, but he doesn't want to. And
but even choosing not to fight is choosing to fight.
Right.
Like there's no way out of that. And I think that was also what happened to Japan during the Iraq War, was that they had to send forces.
Really?
I think so.
Oh, I don't know anything about that.
Well, I was reading, it's an essay kind of talking about the connections between Howl's Moving Castle and the Iraq War. And in that essay, the author is talking specifically about Japanese history and what was going on in Japan during that time. And one of the interesting points that it made that North American audiences may not have picked up on at all is that in 1995, there was a 12-year-old girl raped by three American servicemen, and it was a really big deal. It happened in Okinawa. And so that initial incident in the movie where Sophie is accosted by two soldiers would have immediately made a Japanese audience think about the connection to war and America specifically.
That's horrifying. When did you see that happen?
1995.
Oh, wow. Well, certainly, I mean, the behavior of soldiers during wartime is something that's come up like frequently in his films. But yeah, that's...
And firebombing as well is another sort of direct reference to what happened in Japan.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And we do get some details in the film about how a lot of civilians are being killed by these huge kind of mechanized bombers, these giant like flying ships that are bombing the countryside in this war. One of the things I've always found really interesting about the depiction of war in this film, and I know it's one of the things that gets criticized, but I find it really interesting that we don't really ever get a sense of who is who. Like, there are clearly two kingdoms at war, but it's not really clear which kingdom is which. Like, there's no real distinguishing features between the two of them.
And I think that was kind of the point, because Miyazaki's stance on the Iraq War was that he didn't want to choose a side. Apparently, what George W. Bush said at the time was, you were either on our side or you're on the terrorist side.
Right.
The axis of evil. And Miyazaki's response was, I'm on no one's side.
Yeah. Well, he's profoundly, profound anti-war, like,
he's a pacifist.
He is, and he's a pacifist, absolutely. And it's, you know, it's something that's comes up again and again and again in his work. Although I think, like, this movie is unique in that it deals explicitly with what it's like to live during a war and also to be conscripted to fight one that you have no interest mm-hmm. in, like,
and to learn how to love during war as well. And it's interesting that the way in which everyone's curses are broken is through love, that it's Sophie's kiss and the neighboring kingdom's prince's love for Sophie that ends the war.
Going back to the fairy tale themes that you had mentioned.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's very much a very strong connection between this and Beauty and the Beast, which, you know, Miyazaki would, again, Ponyo is basically the Little Mermaid, so mm-hmm. he definitely has an affection for fairy tales and fairy tale themes and utilizes them in his work again mm-hmm. and again.
Which is probably what drew him to the book Howl's Moving Castle, because mm-hmm. it uses fairy tale tropes and themes as well.
Yeah, another thing I think that maybe drew him to the book as well is the very non-judgmental way in which magic is portrayed. Like, that's something that I really noticed about Kiki's Delivery Service, which I just watched for the first time.
Non-judgmental?
Yeah.
In what, like, way?
Well, what I mean is that, you know, in sort of Western culture, witches are linked to witchcraft and paganism. Like,
okay.
You know, like Western Christian culture definitely views magic and wizardry and witchcraft, like, traditionally speaking, in negative terms. There is a cultural judgment applied. Wizards get it easy because
Harry Potter.
Until, yeah. But even then, like, a lot of, like...
Yeah, there were still, I mean... As a personal example, I didn't read Harry Potter until I was like 25 because I grew up in a Christian school and wizards were not a thing we messed with.
And yet in Kiki's Delivery Service, like, witches basically go to a community and provide services to that community that the community requires. Yeah. Everybody loves the fact that there are witches in their communities.
And it's totally normal. It's just like, this is part of life. And that's the same way that the book and the film operate, although
in Howl's Moving Castle,
yeah although the book definitely gets more in depth about the sort of world of wizardry and the training of witches and wizards,
right? But in the book it's basically like, so Howl has businesses set up in a bunch of different communities and people are just knocking on his door all day asking for magical remedies to their problems, mm-hmm. including, like, I need a little bit more wind in my sails, you know, like,
yeah,
or
make sure my dad comes home.
Exactly.
Doesn't drown.
Yeah. And so it's all very kind of basic magic to help people solve their problems. And it's really only the magic of somebody like the Witch of the Waste that is viewed as problematic. And in the case of the book, it's because she is heartless and greedy, essentially. And they say that in the film, too, that the Witch of the Waste was very greedy, and that kind of greed poisoned her, like it took her over like a demon almost.
Well, and in the book and the film, it's actually a demon.
Yes, yeah. In the case of the book, it is her fire demon that is, like, basically taken over from her body. But yeah, in the book, it's more like her possessiveness for Howl and everything else that she desires has mm-hmm. kind of corrupted her. And, you know, so it's, and in the case of Howl, it's like when he uses his magic for a destructive purpose, that's what corrupts it. But magic itself is kind of a neutral force. It's what you do with it that matters.
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked about the plot and we've talked about the characters now and some of the changes that have been made, as well as we talked about the themes of war and how that plays out in the film in a way it never really did in the book at all. One thing I do kind of want to talk about, because it's such a central feature of the book and the film, is the setting, both the castle itself as well as the the kingdom in which it takes place and kind of some of the ways that that is different. So the castle specifically, I mean, it's the single most memorable part of the movie, I think. And we've already kind of talked about how, you know, it looks like this animal, like a dog. It's got a huge tongue. It walks around on these chicken legs. But in the book, the castle is kind of like a floating industrial fortress.
Yeah, it's never really clear how it moves in the book.
Right. One of the things I think is really interesting about the decision to adapt it the way it did is, so Miyazaki is, he paints his own storyboards. So he is like the storyboard director as well as the director of the film. He draws out, he sketches out the storyboards and then paints them and then gives them to his animators who then contribute to the process of creating it. One of the things I thought was really interesting is that in some of the notes I was reading on the creation of the castle, that Miyazaki wanted, he very explicitly wanted the castle to look both natural and architectural. So he wanted to make sure that it had, you know, a personality, that it had a character. The setting is a character, trope.
The castle is a character.
The castle definitely is a character.
But the larger setting is really like the kingdom and the land.
Mm-hmm. But one of the things I think Miyazaki wanted to emphasize as well thematically in his film is that modernity that doesn't include the natural world is a sort of a corrupted modernity. Whereas the castle being this kind of fusion of something natural and living with something that is artificial and architectural is a kind of ideal. And one of the things I thought was interesting is that he kept telling his artists to make the castle like dirtier, to cover it in more like dirt and grime and grass and make it look more natural rather than
like part of the landscape.
Very much so, yeah.
It is kind of camouflaged throughout the film as well.
Yeah.
Which sort of lends itself to it being part of the landscape.
Another really memorable aspect of this film, I think, anyways, for me, is the wastes and the depiction of the wastes, especially when Howl takes Sophie to through the portal in the door to the waste that is like this huge meadow. Miyazaki took his animation crew to Alsace in France for like 12 weeks. Whoa. Where they could study the French countryside and study the Alsatian countryside and like the mountains and stuff, to get a sense of this very European landscape that he wanted to create. Because he deliberately wanted to make sure that the world of Howl's Moving Castle, the film, was kind of based in sort of a 19th century rural European ideal.
Yeah, it definitely comes off that way too. And it sort of departs from his earlier films as far as the way that the setting is depicted. Most of his other films are very much set in Japan, and you can tell.
Some of them are, but I think there's always been a little bit of a desire on his part to fuse European and Japanese traditions of art and design together. Like, mm-hmm. again, back to Kiki's Delivery Service, but even Castle in the Sky. Yeah. Like, Castle in the Sky, the small town that the movie starts in, like, really has this kind of 18th or 19th century feel to it. This kind of, like, post-industrial revolution, but pre-20th century modernism kind of feel to it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess I was mainly thinking of settings like Spirited Away and sure. My Neighbor Totoro.
Okay. I think it's funny, though, that you said that you felt like it was very European, like the look of the wastes, because I know that one of the animators definitely felt that he could not sort of remove an essential Japanese, like, feeling from the landscape, and that
oh, that's funny.
He constantly had to struggle to make the mountains look more European, because the only mountains that they have in Japan are like Mount Fuji, and they look very pyramid like whereas mm-hmm. That's not the way that, like, say the Swiss Alps look or something like that.
Right.
But I felt like they looked fairly European too, and the way that they portrayed the wastes definitely reminded me of the opening scene of The Sound of Music.
And the town, too.
Yeah.
The town is also very Victorian.
Yeah.
With the train constantly going through in front of the hatter shop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, the world of the film has these sort of, like, impossible for the time period, you know, giant mechanized bombers. But everybody's still relying on like horse and carriage, and everybody dresses like they're in kind of the 19th century. So
yeah, that's what I love about fantasy.
Well, you can play with time periods in a way that you can't otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's interesting because in the book, so one of the things about the book is that Howl the Wizard is actually from our world, basically.
Yeah, that's the other big departure that the film makes from the book. Is that Howl is actually from Wales.
Yeah.
And he has a family there.
Yes.
Well, it's his sister and her husband and their kids.
Yes.
And they think he's a deadbeat.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious.
And it's kind of interesting because you kind of get the sense in the book that Howl Jenkins, which is his real name, he calls himself the Wizard Jenkins in mm-hmm. the book and the film,
and
as well.
Howl.
Yeah, Howl, like H-O-W-E-L-L.
But, like, what were their names in Gilligan's Island?
Oh, you're asking the wrong person.
Mr. and Mrs. Howl? Well, that's who I thought
I just remember, like, Gilligan, Skipper, and then the two very bangable ladies that they end up on the island with.
That's yeah. just Ginger and Marianne.
Right.
I watched a lot of Gilligan's Island as a kid.
What I was going to say, though, was that like in the scenes in Wales, like his family is definitely middle class, but they've like worked really hard to get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like you said, they view Howl as a deadbeat, and Howl kind of went to the magical world to sort of seek his fortune, much like Sophie sets out in the beginning to seek her fortune.
Yeah.
But it also brings up this point that is completely absent from the film, which is that class and social structure and labor are hugely important. Like,
in the book, yeah.
In the book, very much so. And that's a theme that is kind of completely absent from the film. You know, there's nothing really in it about people being exploited for their labor or people trying to rise above their social class. Which I can kind of understand why, because I think the books, Diana Wynne Jones is an English author. I think she was born in Bristol. She pretty much lived her whole life in England. I think like the book has a very English sense of class and sort of various class structures within society, which I don't think would like make a lot of sense in the context of a Japanese adaptation. You know, even though I'm sure Miyazaki saw his film as likely going to play before a worldwide audience, like I don't think he ever sees himself as making films strictly for a Japanese audience. But I think,
and it's not really a theme that he's interested in either.
No, I can't really think of many films of his where class, like, I mean, you could read class into things, but I don't think it's something that he cares about all that much.
Mm-hmm. And I think that adding Wales into the film would have made it feel really incongruous with the rest of the film. Like
how so?
Adding the real world into a film that is largely fantastic and otherworldly.
Right. Well,
it would have felt almost intrusive.
It plays really heavily into the final act of the book, you know, with the Witch of the Waste, and she ends up like threatening his family. Mm-hmm. So they come back to
It's just an avenue for the Witch of the Waste to get to Howl.
Right.
Whereas in the film, it's not really necessary.
No, I do think it kind of underlies one of the issues that I have with the movie, though, which is, it's very difficult to sort of parse through what Howl's motivations are or who he is as a character. I mean, his major motivation is, I don't want to fight in a war. But that's kind of all we really get from him. We don't know where he comes from. We don't even really know that Jenkins is his real name. Like, he goes by multiple names, Howl Pendragon, Howl Jenkins.
And he explicitly states that he uses multiple aliases so he can remain free.
Yeah, he's just Howl. And I kind of...
Just a wizard.
And that problem with character motivation, though, I do think sort of... It does affect the film. I mean, I won't say that I don't find this movie at times to be somewhat meandering in a way that I don't really feel like the book is. Like, I don't get a real good sense of forward momentum through the plot. And the stuff that the scenes where the war is interjected into the movie, it really takes away, in some ways, for me anyways, from the focus on Sophie, which I think is one of the movie's strongest aspects, is, like you were saying, her journey for self-discovery.
Yeah, that the film is meandering is a common criticism that I've seen in a lot of reviews. I don't find it overly meandering. I really enjoy the pace of it. Even just thinking about, like, the scene where Howell essentially surprises Sophie with the field of flowers, I find a really sort of welcome break, because it focuses on the sort of blossoming of their love, I guess. Oh, wow. That's a pun. That was not on purpose. I am not the punny one in this relationship, I swear.
Yeah, right. No, I agree with you. I mean, I don't find that scene to be meandering. I just think that it takes a while for this film to sort of find its footing, because it's trying to adapt the book, but also Miyazaki's trying to interject his sort of pet themes into the narrative. And it's at the halfway point of the movie where it really, really diverges from the book and becomes Miyazaki's film, pretty much as soon as Sophie goes to visit Madame Suliman. And that's where, like, the war theme really kicks into high gear, and we get this real big deviation from the text. Not in a bad way, I don't think, but it definitely marks a sort of the break between the adaptation and the source text, which is fine, because adaptations can be their own things, and I think that this movie does succeed in being memorable on its own terms.
And you have to keep in mind too that everyone brings their own views and pet theories and likes and dislikes to whatever they're adapting and whatever they're watching. So in our case, part of talking about how we first encountered the books and the film, and just in general, like, what do we like, that's going to color the way that any audience encounters an adaptation.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know that for some people who encounter the books first, like, have,
they usually have a stronger affinity for the book.
Absolutely. And in many cases, a more negative view of this adaptation.
Yeah. Which is something that the movie suffered from a bit when it came out, was that some fans of the book were disappointed by the adaptation.
Right. And going back to read the book, I can totally understand why, because it is very strong in ways that the film is not. But going back and, like, rewatching the film, I still think that it's an absolutely gorgeous movie. You know, it's Miyazaki, at least in terms of the animation. I mean, the team that he brought to this film were people that worked on him with that worked with him on Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away, which are some of the films that have some of his greatest animation. And I think this movie has some really incredible sequences that, like, just from a visual standpoint alone, I think that this movie has some real breathtaking moments. Also, absolutely love the music. I mean, I love the music in most of his movies. They're almost always scored by Joe Hisashi. And Hisashi's score in this is very memorable as well. I played a little bit of it at the beginning of the episode. Not his usual synthesizer stuff. This is more almost like it's like a string arrangement in kind of waltz time, like da na 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 na. You know, like, I really like that stuff.
Music is not my strong suit.
Well, we don't have to talk about it at length, but I
agree. Like, I really love the music in Miyazaki's movies, and I find that they always add an emotional aspect.
Yeah,
they work together with the visual aspects.
I mean,
the scene, again, of Sophie seeing the field of flowers is incredibly moving. It's this sort of beast revealing, you know, a library for Belle moment. Like, that's the sort of emotional impact they're looking for.
everything in this library is yours. No, but and that's why I wanted to bring the music up, because you know, Hisashi is so important to Miyazaki's films, and his music really helps create sort of the emotional space that the viewer is going to participate in. And, you know, music is something that books don't have, you know, unless you're listening to the soundtrack, you know, on Spotify or whatever, while you're reading the book in the room,
you're not to time that really well.
Yeah. You're not going to get that accompaniment, but I feel like,
I'm sure Spotify has an app for that.
Maybe, but it's a really important part of the movie, and it's a memorable aspect. In fact, this movie won an award for best music at the Tokyo Anime Awards in 2005. This movie, we should also mention, like, it was very highly acclaimed. It was nominated for the 78th Academy Award for Best Animated Feature. It did not win, unfortunately.
Do you know what won?
I can look, but I don't know off the
Google
top
it.
Of my head.
Go it's now.
Probably something by Pixar. It was, but
not that there's anything wrong with Pixar.
It did, however, win an award for technical achievement at the 61st Venice Film Festival, which is, you know, a huge festival. It also won several awards through various Japanese festivals, like the Tokyo Anime Awards, Japan Media Arts Festival. It also won a Nebula Award in 2007 for Best Script. Let me see, 78th Academy Awards. Winners. Let's see. Best animated feature. Oh, weird. Oh.
What, when?
Okay, give me your drum roll.
Make sound effects. I'm not the sound effect guy.
Wallace and Gromit, The Curse of the Were-Rabbit.
Oh, whatever.
Yeah, right? That's a really odd choice. I mean, I don't dislike it, but...
I watched Wallace and Gromit as a kid, but I don't think I would ever want to watch it as an adult.
It was only one of three movies nominated for that award.
What was the other one?
The Corpse Bride.
Oh, I love that movie.
Okay, but...
Everyone goes, boo.
Okay, it's not a... I don't think it's a bad movie, but it's certainly not in the same class as Howl's Moving Castle.
Well, yeah. Howl's Moving Castle is obviously the top out of that, but I still like Corpse Bride, just saying.
So something that we've talked a lot about, you know, Miyazaki adapting this text. And when you look at adaptations, you always have to ask the question of, like, who is doing the adapting and how does that affect it? Something I thought was really interesting as I was looking in the history of this film is that, you know, one of the people that was actually originally tapped by Studio Ghibli to adapt this was Mamoru Hosoda, who is a Japanese filmmaker that has become very well known recently in the last, like, decade, after making movies like The Girl Who Leapt Through Time in 2006, Summer Wars in 2009, Wolf Children in 2012, and then 2015's The Boy and the Beast. Mamoru Hosoda has really kind of become, in many people's eyes, this sort of successor to Miyazaki since Miyazaki's retirement after The Wind Rises. But apparently, after several pitches to Studio Ghibli to try and adapt the film, they basically said, yeah, we don't really like any of your ideas. This isn't working out.
Ouch.
Yeah, so Hosoda was out, and then Ghibli, or Miyazaki, sort of took the reins over himself. And I can't help but wonder kind of what that film would have looked like had Hosoda been able to finish it. But, you know, that's adaptation. It's a process, and it's really about the collaboration between all these different people. And, you know, clearly this movie wouldn't have been what it was without Miyazaki's initial storyboards, without those painted storyboards, as well as all the animators that worked on the film and contributed to the overall look of the movie.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the way that I want to sort of wrap things up is with a parting question.
Okay.
And so the big question is, do we think the film betrayed the text in any way, or do we think the film managed to transcend the text and stand on its own? Is it ultimately successful as an adaptation?
Oh, well, there's a couple questions there. But
all the questions.
Okay. Do I think it betrayed the text? No, I don't think it betrayed the text. I mean, I definitely think that the adaptation is its own thing. I think Miyazaki's film can in many ways stand on its own as a kind of singular work of art, separate from its source. I do kind of wish that...
And obviously it did for both of us,
yeah,
because we encountered the film first, even without knowing that it was an adaptation.
Yeah, exactly. I knew about this movie for probably 7 or 8 years before I ever, you know, found out about the books that it was based on. At the same time, you know, I do wish that some of what is in the text, especially like the depth of character that we get and the changes to some of those characters, I do prefer them in the book. And there are characters that are like missing entirely from the movie that I wish were in it. But that doesn't ruin the film for me. So I don't know how I feel though about it transcending. I mean, it's impossible for me to remove the movie from my mind, even when I was reading the book. And this is something that I just have this quote from Hutchins' book that I want to draw upon. She says, in the move from print to performance, in particular, characters and places become incarnate in a way that conditions how we imagine them in a literary work when we return and reread it. Our imaginations are permanently colonized by the visual and aural world of the films. But what if we have never read the novels upon which they are based? Do the novels then effectively become the derivative and belated works, the ones we then experience second and secondarily? For unknowing audiences, adaptations have a way of upending sacrosanct elements like priority and originality. And I think that's something that I sort of was keeping in mind as I was reading the book. And it was really impossible for me to shake a lot of the visual interpretations from the film as I was reading it. I pretty much always saw Howl in the book as Howl from the movie. Even when he's wearing different costumes, I kind of envision him as being that. Same goes for Sophie. Calcifer,
with Christian Bale's voice.
With Christian Bale's voice, yes. And, you know, the castle itself, as much as I like the idea of the castle as being this kind of like floating hovercraft castle, as it's sort of depicted in the book, I definitely prefer Miyazaki's interpretation of that. It's hard for me to say that the film transcends, but I think that both the book and the film are superior to each other in their own rights. And they also both have flaws that are sort of reflected in the other.
I would agree with that. I really like both the film and the book. And again, like it's really difficult to separate the two now that I've experienced both. Even in reading the book for the first time, I found it difficult to sort of center myself within the world of the novel because I was already trying to inscribe what I knew about the film onto the book. So it really took until my second read through to really give myself over to the book's interpretation or the book's material.
Right. Yeah. I didn't have as much of a problem sort of getting into the world of the book, but certainly in my imagination, some things were just solidified to the point where I had a hard time seeing them as something else. Like when I was reading, every time the Witch of the Waste, for example, appeared in the book, she's quite different in the book. She's actually kind of portrayed as this vampy sort of femme fatale, a very like, skinny.
I was almost picturing her as sort of a Poison Ivy character.
Yeah, I mean she's full of this kind of sexuality, but also there's a real kind of anger and derangement in her. Like I kind of almost see her as like
way more evil,
like the Evil Queen for Maleficent from like Sleeping Beauty. That's kind of more how I like thought the Witch of the Waste, or like a.
See, I didn't skew that old. I was still thinking,
okay, maybe
like
younger.
Young and beautiful, but corrupt.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. Like, again, she is very much a femme fatale. They describe her as kind of an orchid of the wastes. Like, so to think about her in the terms of the film, it was hard to shake that visual representation. And again, it's you know, it's no surprise that, you know, the excellence of the visuals of the film end up sort of sticking with you in your mind so strongly because they are very powerful images.
Yeah. And that's something that we've kind of been talking about through this whole episode, is that readers and viewers are going to impose meaning on the text or the film. There's really no way to sort of strip away your own lens.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So I guess that's sort of, I mean, the only thing we really haven't touched on is the voiceovers. Do you want to talk about the voices at all?
We talked a little bit about Billy Crystal.
Yeah.
And I love Christian Bale as Howell.
I go think back it and makes forth him, on him.
I think it makes him sexier. I'm just going to say it. Because he's very feminine in the movie. And
yeah, he's a glamour boy.
Depicted, like, he's very tuxedo guy, but with the deep voice. There's right. something about that deep voice that's like, I don't know, just amps up the sexy factor.
Come with me, Sophie. Yeah, no, I'm okay with him. I think Billy Crystal is fine for Calcifer. I mean, he's Billy Crystal, so it's like
his... How can you hate Billy Crystal?
I don't hate him. His voice is delightful. It's just when you read the book and you, I think get a very different.
He had a little bit of the genie in him too when he's freed at the end. Like, I kept just hearing Robin Williams in the back of my head going, "I'm free, I'm free."
I mean, one of the things that's really interesting about the movie is that we also get two different voices for Sophie.
And I think that was another good choice because it goes along with the visual fluctuations of her character. And it makes it so much more powerful. One of my favorite moments is when she stands up for Howell when she's talking to Madame Suliman. And she sort of unknowingly is growing younger. And it's the voice change that cues you at first. And it's so much more powerful when it's said in the younger voice, because it's one of the first times you see her feeling comfortable to use her own voice.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's a very powerful moment, and a lot of that is sold by the voice acting and the change to Emily Mortimer's voice, who plays the younger, or I guess the real version of Sophie. I can't recall who played the older Sophie here.
I thought it was like a Joanne something.
Let's see.
You're going into the IMD rabbit hole.
Oh, come no. back. Man, it's, why don't you have old Sophie as like the first voice actor? Anyways, it doesn't matter. Yeah, it's such a great moment. Overall, I think the voices are pretty great. This is funny. I didn't realize Jenna Malone is one of the voices in this.
Who's she in the movie?
Apparently she was the voice of Letty.
Of Letty? So the sister.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I didn't even pick up on that.
And I didn't pick up on it either.
She has a pretty unique voice.
Yep. Also, we talked about the ways in which the Witch of the Waste is kind of given this sort of erotic, voluptuous quality. Well, the voice of the Witch of the Waste in the English language dub is Lauren Bacall, who is like, you know, one of the all-time great-looking, you know, actresses of the early film era. Like, you know, we're talking like 1940s and 50s. Like, she was a very sexy looking woman,
which explains why I'm sitting here looking blank.
But it works, and she has a great voice. Like, her voice is quite sultry. Yeah, I think we've covered Howl's Moving Castle pretty comprehensively, I think.
So I guess we both think that the adaptation succeeded.
Oh yeah, I think this is a very successful adaptation, and I like the movie despite having some problems with the pacing and with the lack of character motivation.
Yeah, I still really enjoy the film, even now that I've read the book. The film is still something that I think of fondly as one of my first experiences with Miyazaki, and in having a character that I really identify with.
Yeah, and I mean, as much as I have some issues with the change in plot and the focus on sort of war and the experience of life during wartime, I can still appreciate it. And reading some of the history and looking into, you know, why it was done, I can kind of appreciate that why those changes were made. And, you know, again, we always have the book, so you can always go back to the source text if you don't like the adaptation.
Read it again. That's what I do.
So some of you have already sent in your feedback to us through the Facebook group that we have set up. If you are listening to this episode for the first time and you want to tell us what you think of Howl's Moving Castle, either the book or the film, please do send us some feedback. You can send in your thoughts to textualrelationspodcast@gmail.com, and we'll address it either in the next appendix episode, which should be coming out in a few weeks, or we'll address it on a future appendix if you can't get it to us right away. We'd like you to read along with us, to watch along with us, and experience these adaptations through the podcast. But we understand that we're still growing our audience, so people are going to be playing catch up. So we'll allow like a little bit of a grace period, and we'll answer questions about previous adaptations that we've done in future appendices. But we would like it if we were, you know, in the future, we can start, you know, making sure that each appendix is sort of just related to the adaptation that we just covered. So again, if you have any thoughts about Howl's Moving Castle, send it to textualrelationspodcast@gmail.com.
And follow along in our Facebook group,
yep,
which is just Textual Relations Podcast, I believe.
No, it's facebook.com/groups/textualrelations, or you can just find us on Facebook by searching Textual Relations, and you should be able to find us.
And we should be announcing the book and film we'll be doing next very soon.
Well, we can announce it on this episode.
Or we can announce it now.
Yeah. So what are we doing next?
We're going to be covering Vile Bodies next month, which is a book by Evelyn Waugh. And the film adaptation is called Bright Young Things. They're both really fun. They're sort of party books and movies.
Yeah, they're set in the Roaring Twenties.
Yeah.
Although I think the movie is more fun in many ways than the book, as we'll probably discuss.
I mean, it's Waugh, so it's going to be a little bit depressing, but it's not going to be Brideshead Revisited depressing.
I think this is like something that will probably appeal to you and I a lot more than anybody who happens to read it, but maybe, you know, people will surprise themselves.
I think it's a quirky book. It's fun. It's got a lot of like random slang, and I think anyone who has gone through a party phase in their life will feel this book.
All right. So yeah, get your copies of Vile Bodies. It's pretty easy to get a hold of. You can get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Chapters or on various, I think it's probably even, there's probably a Kindle version available for it. We both own it in paperback form, so that's not really an issue for us. But the movie might be a little bit harder to get a hold of, but I'm sure it's also, I know it's available for sure on DVD. So yeah, you can do a little bit of digging. It might be available for streaming, that I cannot confirm. But we'll be back in 1 month with that. And you can find this episode and more episodes, or future episodes, I should say, at textualrelationspodcast.com. And that's it. That's the first episode. So thank you very much for listening. And yeah, we'll
tune in next time.
We'll be back in 1 month. So until then, the library's closed.